Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hello, fellow Creative Control listeners. My name is Mac Cameron. I live in Toronto, and I have been listening to Creative Control with Vish Khanna since episode 119 that featured all five members of one of my favorite bands, Constantines. I listen backwards from there and then forwards, and I know it sounds, you know, over the top or cliche, but finding the show changed the course of my life. It inspired me to pursue a career in radio and to do what I can to support the arts in my community and across the country. So I give to Creative Control because I feel like I owe the show and Vish for helping me figure out what the hell to do with my life. Beyond that, I give to Creative Control because I think independent media, especially insightful, entertaining, thoughtful, and thorough independent media, is something that is worth paying for. What I appreciate about Creative Control is Vish's ability to treat Canadian artists, or any artist for that matter, with the seriousness and appreciation he would any other artist. His excellent rapport with people like Steve Albini and the members of Fugazi and Stephen Malkmus and others have earned him international appreciation. However, it's his trove of interviews with what I consider to be the most exciting generation of Canadian musicians, conducted out of genuine passion and interest, that makes this show so special. I think it is an archive of some really exciting music that is way, way underreported on and appreciated. That's why I contribute to Creative Control with Vish Khanna, and I hope you will do the same.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do, and now he has me on the record saying that.
Joe Casey is a wondrous lyricist and lead singer based in Detroit, Michigan. Over the past decade, Casey has fronted Proto Martyr, one of this century's most significant underground rock bands. Renowned for a live show that is equally explosive and enigmatic, Proto Martyr have released five multi-layered albums, including 2020's reflective Ultimate Success Today, which came out on July 17th via Domino Records. Marking his third appearance on this show, Joe Casey and I caught up for a discussion about the socio-cultural status of the United States of America as it negotiates civil unrest, police brutality, and all the while serving as the Earth's epicenter for the spread of COVID-19 during a pandemic, how he may well have predicted all of those things in writing some new proto-martyr songs, political polarization and the end of decorum, why Alberta doesn't have any rats, Ghostface Killa and Thin Lizzy, Little Caesar's Pizza and Hypochondria, future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Cold Specs, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 552nd episode of Creative Control, featuring the thoughtful and talented Joe Casey with your host, me, Vish Khanna. With a smile, being processed by the boys. Hi, Joe. How's it going?
Pretty good.
That's good. Nice to speak with you again, and welcome back to the show. Where in the world are you today?
I'm currently in the suburb of Clawson, which is outside of Detroit. It's where my brother lives, and he has good Wi-Fi, so we could connect and talk today. I don't have Wi-Fi.
Well, and how do you function without Wi-Fi in this day and age? I know some people dream of not having Wi-Fi, and you are living the dream. How do you get away with not having Wi-Fi in this day and age?
Well, the house, I haven't been living in that house since the quarantine started. And, you know, usually you just go and you'd visit your brothers who have the cable and the air conditioning and the Wi-Fi and the stock fridge, and you take advantage of familial love. So that's what I did.
So have you abandoned your own home?
No, I go back and, you know, mow the lawn and check on the mail. But yeah, it just started because my brother went over to his girlfriend's house. And so the house was free. His house was free. So I felt like I was doing him a favor by checking on his mail. It's a terrible cycle of checking on mail and mowing lawns and things. Yeah.
Okay. In the grand scheme of things, meaning as we're speaking, the pandemic is still with us and surging is occurring in various United States and around the world. What's your frame of mind like living through this, and what's the status? Every time you've been on the show, you've given me a Detroit status update, I feel like.
Sure.
So I might as well ask, why not? Why not now? As I often ask people I talk to about status updates, how is Detroit? How are you doing in Detroit?
Let's see. Well, I haven't really been into the city, downtown Detroit, since March 11th, I think, was the last time I was down there.
March 11th.
So, yeah, because we had started a tour on March 11th in Detroit. We drove to Kalamazoo to pick up Kelly Deal, who was driving up from Dayton, and then we're going to Chicago for the first of our three-day little mini tour to kind of practice with Kelly. And as we were driving to Chicago, our Kalamazoo show got canceled and our Columbus show got canceled. And the Chicago show barely happened. And then after that, we came back home to Detroit, and that's when it kind of all started. Hmm. The state of Detroit, I thought the protests, from what I've heard, have been going very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think especially because there is specific demands that people have. We're not getting, they tried to make a big thing where, you know, oh no, they're rioting, but Detroit had really none of that. Maybe a few smashed windows. These things happen. So I thought that the protests were, are going very well. Like they're still going on and they're timed correctly. And, you know, there's goals behind them. And, but yeah, I mean, there's, as far as the mask wearing, it seemed like at the beginning of this thing, my part of Detroit, Northwest Side, was hit very, very hard. We had the youngest person of the state in the state to die of COVID in, from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, it seemed like Detroit was handling it pretty well. We had some testing that you could go to and, but I think everybody just could not sacrifice. And I think, you know, people, the combination of capitalism needing to continue no matter what, and, people not having the courage or the ability to, wear a mask is, going to bite us in the ass, again, and, keep me out of a job, for at least until 2021, if not longer now, because of, our inability to have, to stay the course. So,
right. Okay. So, huh. That was a bit interesting. You seem to suggest that Detroit was dealing with some things well and some things not so well. And in terms of the pandemic, people are not, by your observation and by the rate of the virus spreading, they're not abiding by the social distancing protocols and the mask wearing protocols. That's your assessment.
Well, my assessment, I would say that when I'm in, when I'm back to my house, my neighborhood, people are wearing masks, and I think Detroiters are taking it seriously as much as they can. I think the governor was nice and was strict, which, you know, there's always a worry that maybe somebody's too strict. Like, why is she not allowing this and not allowing that? But overall, I think compared to some states, she was, had a pretty clear policy of, you know, social distancing and things being closed. But I think just from what I'm sensing, I just feel like a lot of people are just kind of giving up. You know, they're trying to get back to, you know, I it's one of the reasons why I hate Instagram or something, is that you can see the people that are kind of, and that goes for both the protesting and, you know, the other issues at hand, you know, with Black Lives Matter and police brutality and wearing a mask and realizing that we're in a pandemic. So, you know, I hate to be policing people, but you see people like, now I'm having a wonder, you know, people have already gone back to their normal lives or trying to, and I think it's probably too soon.
I've never, it's a bizarre perfect storm of stuff though, right? Because these protests, I think you're advocating for them and you view them as necessary, as do I, as do many people. However, there's the pandemic at the same time. So the notion of gathering together with other people and potentially spreading the disease, masks or no, it's complicated because the protests should be happening. This is the time for them to be happening, but it's also the time for us to probably be isolating from each other, much in the way you would if you did not attend a protest, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Right. But I think part of the reason why the protests were so effective in the first place and why they were able and still able to do continual pressure, where it's not just a thing where, hey, we're going to march this weekend and see it. You know, when the next cop shoots somebody, we'll get back together. See you then. It's because of the quarantine, because people are out of jobs, and because they're able. You say it's a perfect storm. It's a perfect storm that allows this level of thing. And then the question you have to ask yourself is like, if these protests are to be effective, that I'd rather sacrifice myself to protest these indignities against the human body than whether or not I can go and get my hair cut.
Well, yes. We saw white people protest in the first wave of the pandemic, I think about 4 or 5 weeks in, there were the image. And by the way, again, your state is in the news a lot. Your governor is Gretchen Whitmer, right?
Right.
Gretchen Whitmer has been in the crosshairs of your president as a particular target.
Sure.
And these government buildings that were basically invaded by these people protesting the fact that they had to wear masks and practice social distancing. And then there were the armed militias. That all occurred in Michigan too, right?
Sure. I mean, you couldn't, you know, I'm not going to write a 2020 concept album. I mean, someday down the line, someone's going to write a musical this year in the bombed out desert wasteland where the future people will live. There'll be a great 2020 musical. But just and this goes for all sides. It's fascinating to me that in the span of a week, we'll call them the right wing conservative wing of society was like, the government has too much power and they're trying to police my right to go get a haircut and take my boat out on a lake and, you know, and carry my guns and all this stuff. Within a week, and then, of course, you know, the left wing and we're saying, hey, you know, you need to sacrifice. You know, we all need to be in this together. The government needs to tell us what to do so we can get through this pandemic faster. Then a week goes by. You have, you know, this uprising. And now the people that a week ago wanted to bring guns to break the law to get a haircut are now like, these people, you know, George Floyd had it coming. He broke the law. And why don't people follow law and order? And the police need to, you know. And now the left is like, we need to protest. We screw social distancing. We need to come together. And this is most of it. So just in that week to have that kind of wave, you know, you realize that there isn't how emotion and how dyed in the wool people are with their beliefs that there's not a moral center anymore.
There may have been at some point, but the lack of galvanization in your country in particular is, and I say this with all respect, Joe, you know I love you, right? You know that. It's not meant to disparage you or Protomartyr or anything else, but the polarization in your country, to see it from afar, is baffling. The hypocrisy, the flip-flopping, the you know, taking positions when they're convenient for your team, your side.
Yeah.
Like it's not Republican and Democrat didn't used to be this vastly disparate thing that could never compromise. This has happened over time. Somewhat recently, a few months ago, and I don't know, I know he himself is a polarizing figure for some, but I read Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized. Do you know that book?
At first it's like, the guy from Vampire Weekend wrote a book? What? Wow. Guy.
No, I think it's a different guy.
I didn't. No, that's Ezra Koenig, right? I did not.
Okay, Ezra Klein is one of the founders of Vox. He used to be a Washington Post editor, actually. So he founded Vox, which is positions itself as a it's a left leaning, fact oriented publication. And anyway, he is the editor of that thing, and he wrote this book called Why We're Polarized. So I kind of been parroting it to people recently. Again, I know he's a. You don't even know who he is. He's not in Vampire Weekend, but he is a political commentator and an analyst. And he just talks about how everything in your country at some point from around the mid 20th century on became super polarized and politicized, I suppose is the right word. Like, and we're at a point now where the NFL became this politicized thing, right? And it used to be everyone could gather together and watch the game. It didn't matter if you were a Democrat or a Republican or a right wing or left wing. And now everything we do is informed by this political slant. And when I say perfect storm, that's kind of where we're at. This pandemic happened. These protests are happening. And as you say, the protests are happening because people have the time and anger. They have the time on their hands because a lot of people are unemployed and they're mad about that. And then they think about the systemic racism and the systemic issues that your country has, and everything is kind of like, I feel like Black Lives Matter protests are not just about that issue. They seem to be about righteous anger at your government as a whole. Do you see that? But first of all,
yes. And, you know, it's what's fascinating to me now is I feel like there is I feel like the movement itself is kind of being shot by both sides at the moment. Where, and I'm very cognizant of the fact of not being on one of the sides that's shooting at the movement, because I think the movement is very clear. Like the first time I've ever heard to fund the police, I was like, what the hell does that mean? And then it was spelled out to me and I was like, that makes a lot of sense, that we can't have these cities where the policing is, you know, way too much of the budget. Maybe some of the problems that we have in these cities is because the police budget is sucking up all this stuff and turning everything into a military militarized state.
Right. The money that could be going to social programs and other programs is being sucked up by their budget. Yeah.
And what I like about that is that it threads the needle of like, well, who was, when did this start? When did all of a sudden the police force go from, you know, being a thing that was probably corrupt, very corrupt and very racist, but small enough that it wasn't, you know, the prevalent military force in every major city. Mm-hmm. When did that happen? You look back and all that, you know, that was started under Clinton. Mm-hmm. So it's not really, it's not like a right wing left thing, but like, to go back to the I'm worried about the movement being diluted right now because and that's not diluted. That's diluted.
Yes. So, yes. Yes.
Because what's happening is I feel like and we'll just call them the liberal centrists, we'll call them, and we'll call them the corporations and things, are saying like, oh yes, Black Lives Matter, you know, hashtag here's we'll hire more people of color and so please stop protesting, you know. Or the people that are like, we need to tear down all the statues, and that will be, you know, once they're all torn down, that will be like, people are focusing on the statues way too much, both right and left. It's becoming like it's a distraction.
Who cares about statues? You know? The statues thing is insane. I don't understand. Who? No one cares about statues. Literally, no one. I mean, sorry, to your point, everyone does. No one should. They're statues. No one cares. They shouldn't. Sorry, again.
Right.
I realize people care.
It's an issue.
Nobody should care about them.
what I hate about it is I think, you know, I understand why they're brought up, because it's like when people say like, oh, this is a few bad apples, or this is something, you know, America, you know, we've solved racism, which, you know, people, again, both the right and the lazy liberals want to say like, oh yes, it's been, you know, it's been solved, you know. Yeah. I voted for Obama twice.
I should clarify, I don't think those statues should have ever been put up, but the amount of the celebrating.
The reason why they're brought up. The reason why they're brought up is as an example to be like, well, no, actually this isn't baked into the system. And this, like, you know, there's statues, you know, the fact that we've got, you know, in Michigan, we have a bunch of Confederate statues. It's like, well, what, how did that happen? You know?
Yeah.
And for me, it's an interesting thing because like my dad was he's very into the Civil War. Our house is full of books. I might not have Wi-Fi, but I have every Civil War book ever written during my dad's lifetime. He loved it. And so I've been to every Civil War battlefield, and I have seen, like, you know, some pretty janky Civil War monuments and things.
Right.
It makes sense that there would be some monuments on battlefields or in museums and things. It doesn't make any sense that in the mid 20th century, Confederate statues started appearing in small towns in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
That to me does not point to any sort of historical thing. That points to me, that's some sort of racist signpost. So sure. You know, but as far as that being we must protect the statues. You know, it's mind blowing.
I'm with you. You mentioned,
or like Aunt Jemima, we've got to protect Aunt Jemima. There was just the other day, there was a 20 year old woman giving a speech about how Aunt Jemima represented this American dream. Let me ask you this.
She was 20 years old. That's right.
Yeah. When you were 20 years old, did you give a shit about maple syrup? were you like, I gotta, you know, like it sounded like an 80-year-old woman talking on the stage, but she was a 20-year-old, you know, college student. That's when you're like, okay, they're trying to, both sides end up pulling it into the cultural war or totems or symbols.
But doesn't that, isn't that the natural offshoot of a country, particularly yours, and I think it's influenced others, that really views patriotic symbolism as the ultimate expression? Like, very few issues cause controversy in your country in particular than something, some desecration of a symbol. And that's kind of what the statues are, a symbol. The flag is a symbol. Not standing for the kneeling during the national anthem is symbolic. It's really weird how much symbols dictate. Aunt Jemima is an icon of advertising. She's a symbol of some kind. I mean, to the left leaning point of view, she's a negative symbol, as are a lot of African American or Black iconography used for commercials. And most POC, we've talked about team names for decades now that need to be changed. But they're ultimately symbols. And is there something going on there with your country and just like the jingoistic symbolism, and, you know, every football game is like, you know, mired in symbolic imagery. And you all, not you, but a lot of people take that very seriously. And it creates wounds between them. Like, it disconnects people and their symbols. Isn't that weird?
Sure. I mean, but I would say that it's a way to discuss, you know, society, or it's a way to discuss the world. You know, maybe when we were kids, we all had to read signs and symbols, and we're all into like semiotics or something. Like, maybe America's is really into
No, it is. Yeah. Part of what's going on right now, and there's a lot of slogans and symbolism, and you know, when the mayor of Washington D.C. changes the name of a street, a thoroughfare, to Black Lives Matter Plaza, that's a message. It counters the racist street names and statues that were being discussed at the time, but it's adding to this discourse about symbols.
Right. Unfortunately, yeah, it empowers what would be like, and specifically in Detroit, we found out, and it was kind of news to me, like, where it was like, oh, a lot of the, you know, slavery was in Michigan for a while, and a lot of the founding fathers of Detroit, and basically now reduced to, you know, street names, were slave owners.
Right.
And you're like, okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. But is taking down a name of a street that's named after a guy that used to own slaves back in the 1700s, is that, and then replacing it with a very explicit racial name like Black Lives Matter at Boulevard, does that not, I don't think that solves the problem necessarily. Well, and I don't know exactly what the problem is. Like, I feel like it would be, you know, I don't know.
I was just having, I was having a conversation about this with someone the other day, actually, about this specific thing, because it was discovered, or at least brought more attention was brought to the fact that there's a street name in Toronto called Dundas Street. And it was also named after a questionable figure historically. And so there have been calls to change the name. And my guest, Adam Sturgeon of this band, Whoopso, here in Canada, was saying that kind of something along the same lines as what you're saying on one hand. But I think we left it thinking this isn't really for us, that name change. It's for future generations. Because in a way, you name something Black Lives Matter Plaza right now, it has an immediate resonance. But 50 years from now, if someone younger says, why is it called that? Well, why is it called that instead of, you know, Thomas Jefferson Avenue? Or who was Thomas Jefferson? Or who was so-and-so? Who was the figure you're talking about in Detroit? Instead of talking about them, you're talking about the issue. And so it's, on some level, that's probably for the best, isn't it?
It is. I generally support iconoclasts, but the problem I have, and because I'm not an expert on this, and I don't feel like I have a very superior political standpoint, is I'm I think like most people, where I would be like, yeah, you know, Stone Mountain, Georgia, that giant, where it's like the giant statues of the three, you know, Lee and like, blow that up, you know, tear down the statue. But I bet you it would get to the point where they'd be like, now we got to tear down this guy's statue. And I'd be like, wait a minute, but I like that guy. Like, eventually they get to a point where there'd be some statue where I'd be like, but that's actually, it's irony. Or like, you know, I would get to the point where I try to defend the statue. And then I would be like, why am I, you know, how did I get pulled into this signs and symbols debate?
Yeah.
When the issues, you know, in our conversation just got derailed by it.
I suppose it did.
So
I was just asking how things were going. My question was, how's things going? I think.
Right.
And then,
well, how's things going in Canada? Everything, the land of milk and honey, got no problems up there in Canada?
No, it's just as bad. We have a smaller population, but we have loads and loads of systemic racism, more than we know what to do with. And so we have, maybe better healthcare, but still lots of systemic racism and lots of divisions, political divisions, where you would think, because we have a built-in empathy, we would do things together that would help all of us at the same time. But because of the nature of politics and maybe information and the way the media covers things, I don't want to say the media. I said it. I did say the media, and maybe that's simplistic, but the way
it's too broad of a term. It's a symbol. It's a symbol for something.
Well, I do think that we are learning. One of the real interesting aspects of how people have been elected around the world. I just left Ontario. I don't know if you know this, Joe. I live in Alberta now.
Well, I know just because I had to figure out what mountain time was.
Right. Sorry. That's right. Yeah, that's right. We moved in January. My family and I moved from Ontario to Alberta. And at least one of the reasons we left was I just couldn't deal with the this is going to be really ridiculous. We had a really kind of conservative government in Ontario. There's actually a worse government on some level here where I live now in Alberta, but I also, anyway, timing was timing. My wife's family's from here, so we moved. But it's been interesting to learn how, with your president as well, and just how people believe what they want to believe, and they vote accordingly, and it's not really based on facts. And how truth has now become something you can debate. Like, just plain solid facts have been questioned and denigrated to the point where we all are basically trained to mistrust everything we read. And I think that's really led to a deterioration of certainly, you know, social discourse, but also just civility. and so that's kind of where we're at. And I feel like swimming around all the things we just talked about, that's there too. There's just an erosion of decorum that is, and it's maybe, I theorize that it's internet based, but it's spilling into real life like tidal waves now, where the anonymous comment you used to be able to make on the internet isn't doing it for you. So you go out into the street and you yell at someone who's a person of color or different than you.
The internet troll 10 years ago was the sweaty fat guy in his basement that no one gave a shit about. And now it's
the sweaty fat guy in the White House.
Right.
The ultimate internet troll was validated by your people. And we've had similar figures here, uneducated leaders, in it for a quick bucks. Literally, like, this is spreading around the world. And I appreciate what you said earlier about not wanting to be the guy just shooting down the other side, so to speak, because they are the other side. But I will put forth to you that as more and more information comes to light and you see the true nature of the way people vote and make decisions based on party lines, I think we're starting to see just how shitty some of the parties are. This is a broad brush, but I'm at a point, I would think some of you must be at a point, and I think it's happening in real time. If you're a Republican, I'm not fucking with you. If you're a Democrat, I'm not fucking with you. Like, I don't care what you say because I know you're that. And that's a fracture that I'm concerned. It's been building and building and building, but don't you think that's where you're at right now? Where if you're that, that's it. I'm done.
Well, you can find the more apolitical mind. Like, I think I was probably one of those people living fat and lazy in the apolitical landscape. But like, I see a lot of friends on Facebook and things where they have to admit now where they come to the point where it's people that support Trump at this point. What are their reasonings behind it? And I can't think of a justifiable reason, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is shocking to me that I can't think, well, at least he's fiscally responsible. You know, maybe he locks up people in cages, but he's fiscally responsible. Like, even that I could see, like, oh, this old Republican doesn't want to vote for or doesn't needs to support the Republican Party because he believes in fiscal responsibility. But they haven't been, you know, I don't know. And so if you're supporting him, I have to come to the conclusion, oh, you support the systematic, our immigration system is now shut down to everybody.
Yeah.
That used to be one of the defining principles of America is that we'll take your best and brightest. We'll take people and we'll make them American, mm-hmm. which is maybe one reason why we're so into symbols is that we are, you know, a melting pot, even though it's not really a melting pot, but we are a nation made up of many different peoples.
You're supposed to be a melting pot. That's right. Right.
Right. We're supposed to, you know, there is no like one kind of American. And to me, that's like of all the shit we have to go through to get through Americans, I do feel like that's something that we have over a lot of countries that maybe have better healthcare and maybe, you know, not Canada, but like certainly countries in Europe where their policies of immigration are much, much stricter than America.
Right.
And they kind of are monocultures. And like, why can they live in this socialist utopia? It's like, well, that's because there's only one type of person there, you know, but not, it's not a melting pot, you know, yeah. It's actually a very segregated society.
Right.
So,
but I mean, the entire, anyway. Yeah, we're not doctors. We took our shot there trying to fix the world's problems. And
I think we fixed it.
I think we did.
I think it's done.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to figure out why I thought you just moved to Alberta to get away from rats. You're sick of rats.
No, do we have a lot of rats? We don't have rats.
Have no rats.
Well, I didn't have rats. We had mice in my house. We had little tiny mice.
Alberta has no rats.
Is that correct? I didn't know that. We have giant rabbits. We have rabbits the size of small Great Danes. I don't know if that really works as an analogy or comparison, but
it's the size of a baby big dog. No, you gotta look this up, man.
There's not Alberta, a single rat here?
Alberta has spent a lot of time and money to make sure that there's no rats in the whole province.
Really? I did not know that. I mean, I did.
Look up.
I'm so used to mouse. You know, vermin feces and
yeah.
And I did. Oh, when we moved into our house finally, I'm like, it's weird. I'm so used to looking for it, looking for signs of mice, and it was nothing. It's been nothing so far, and I was a bit baffled by it. But yeah, I'll Google it. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's not. It's like the snakes in Ireland. There's no.
Right.
No rats in Alberta.
Well, okay, that's good. I'm learning something about where I'm at. Have you ever been? Yeah. Have you ever been here for band reasons or otherwise?
Yeah, is the Sled Island
in Calgary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've been here the one time?
Just the one time. Nice. Yeah. And our friends and preoccupations are from Alberta.
That's right. That's right. From Calgary as well.
And it stinks that when you're touring, it's like maybe I'll hit. That's why the Sled Island Festival was so great. It gave you a reason to go to Alberta.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So
I want to ask you a question that I'm sure you've had to field since your new album, Ultimate Success Today, began circulating among media weasels like me. Congratulations on the new album, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Here's what I want to read to you to ask you if you are from the future. It is from it's from a song called Process by the Boys. Do you know where I'm going? Do you know where I'm going already?
It depends.
Okay. Let me go. I don't want to. I'm going to try. There's a few things going on in this song that seem prescient, given that I assume it was written before we all began experiencing the things we've been experiencing. Here we go. When the ending comes, is it going to run at us like a wild-eyed animal? A foreign disease washed upon the beach. A dagger plunged from out the shadows. A cosmic grief beyond all comprehension. All good laid low by outside evil, against belief, a riot in the streets, a giant beast turning mountains into black holes. So I thought, wow, there's some COVID-19 pandemic stuff going on in here that I bet Joe wasn't thinking about necessarily. And then, then we got a riot in the streets, and as we're speaking, there have been protests that the police have turned some of them into riots over time.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come from, and what do you make of it now that some of it seems to be more real than maybe you thought it would be? I don't know. Where did this come from?
Well, I'm psychic. No, it's
that's what I was
getting at. Written more than a year ago. In fact, I think it was written like last winter. That's when the song was started. It was one of the first songs we worked on for the album. So it's definitely not about COVID. And it's funny because at the beginning, when we first released the song, and then the very next day, America shut down, literally. Like the day that we announced the album, it was Tom Hanks had reported he had coronavirus, and the NBA was going to suspend the season, so
amazing timing.
At first, the album comes out and people are like, well, you say a foreign disease washed upon the beach, ooh, spooky. And I say, well, no, if you listen, I say that's not going to be what destroys us. It's not going to be these perceived threats from the outside and within. It's going to be the way that we handle them.
Right.
It says fiction. Reality has a far duller edge. And it's about how we give our trust and authority to the state. And it's going to be the bungling of the state that's going to hurt us.
Hmm.
The boys and processed by the boys are the police,
Right.
Are the people in charge.
Right.
And so I was saying that at the beginning, I was like, oh, you see, no, I'm not psychic. I think it's going to be our response to this. And then now it's kind of even become more prescient.
Yeah,
so,
it's an eerie thing to read off the page. It also sounds vaguely like a soul song. It actually reminded me of a Ghostface Killah song called Nutmeg.
Well, that's good. I love Ghostface. So yeah, I'll take that.
Do you know what I mean? It's a song by, I looked it up the other day and I can't remember. I don't know the source of that sample, but do you remember? It's the first song on Supreme Clientele.
Mm-hmm.
It has a similar kind of stabbing part.
Right.
And I don't know where the sound of this song came from or the arrangement, but it seems very soul music oriented, if that makes any sense.
Well, maybe sort of in the back doorway, because you know, the band writes the music, but I have for a long time been trying to write a Thin Lizzy-esque song.
Hmm.
And there's a couple that haven't made the cut. And this is the first one where, you know, when they talk about the boys coming back into town, it's when they, you know, it's kind of a direct reference to when the, you know, boys are back in town. It's kind of like,
right.
After the boys are back in town. Yay. Now we need to get them a job. Well, these idiots can, they'll be our cops, you know? And really the song came from more about, and this is how, here's an easy lesson for your listeners on how to become a psychic. Is that you write about things that are happening today, and invariably they're going to happen again.
All right.
Maybe worse.
All right.
You know, so when I was writing that song last winter, not even this current, you know, like 2018 going into 2019, the main issue was ICE and how ICE was hiring all these people, and ICE, you know, the border army that we have now.
Yeah.
It kind of came out of nowhere.
Right.
But of course was probably bolstered and started by, you know, Obama and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, where are they hiring all these guys from? You know, are they just rejects from the army, or are they former police that have been drummed out for brutality? You know, where are they coming from? And so it was my concern over ICE that was the base. So it's ICE and Thin Lizzy, that song.
Okay. Okay.
And hearing the phrase Tattered Damalion and being like, that should go in a song someday.
Where did you hear that? This is a term for, the line is, in their Tattered Damalion uniforms, they look so nice. Tattered Damalion means kind of like beat up, right? Or
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, just from in that, you've seen, there's been some weird ass, especially in Washington, D.C., there's been like private contractor army guys.
Yeah, we've seen that. Unidentified, unidentified authority figures who seem to act like cops.
Right. And you say, where are you from? And they can't tell you.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I assume it's only because Washington, D.C. is actually owned by the federal government. It's not really, you know, it's one of those weird sort of loopholes. But that is frightening to me. And yeah. I feel like that's going to be one of the consequences of all of this is if we achieve our goals of reducing the police and getting them off the drug of militarization and money being poured into them too. And we get away the loopholes where they can't, you know, or the money, if they get sued for being a violent person, the money doesn't come from taxpayers. It comes from like the force or from them. Accountability. If we somehow stuff accountability back into the police forces, which they should actually want, you know?
Yeah.
Then you push one thing down, the bad things that are going to sprout up are going to be an increase of the surveillance state. That's just going to be, you know, the doorbell ringer things that Amazon is selling, that they give the information directly to the cops.
Yeah, right.
That these cameras that are, you know, so the surveillance state's going to rise up. And then I really honestly feel in Detroit, we have these billionaires that have their camera. I think I talked gassed about them last time.
Yeah, we did. We talked about the Little Caesars Arena, I believe it was, and that family.
During the uprisings, the Little Caesars Arena was used as a holding zone for people that were arrested during the riots. Mm-hmm. So that shows you how corporations and the police work together to oppress the people. But anyway.
Yeah.
So it's going to be surveillance is going to be on the rise, and these private armies, these private security forces are going to get larger.
Yeah.
And there's lots of places that are not, like the area around the pizza stadium is owned by the Illiches, and they'll put in eventually, right now they haven't put in shit, but when they put in stuff, as soon as you cross into their property, you'll be on private property, and they will probably be able to have a private police force that will be way more militarized than the actual police force. So why the police force, maybe as people, we can fight to demilitarize them and get them back into, you know, not so violent roles, the private sector will increase guys with these tatterdemalion uniforms, you know, this shitty military uniforms.
I thought of you somewhat recently because I thought a story began circulating about how that family, what's the name of the family again that owns Little Caesars?
The Illiches.
Illiches.
Yeah, the Illiches.
I thought I read a kind of feel-good story about how they, one of the members of the family actually paid Rosa Parks' rent. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Exactly right. Yeah, that was the that was Mike Illich, the founders of Little Caesars Pizza, who had passed away. And this was kind of like, I bet you didn't know that Mike paid for Rosa Parks for years.
And so there's a spin, a little spin they were putting on this guy's life, maybe?
Yeah. They were celebrating the dead, which is okay. So he's dead now.
Yeah.
But then they're bringing up the fact that the controlled blight that they do, and the fact that they've kicked out people that live in the city and that they sit on these abandoned properties that turns the city into a ghetto, and they destroy properties, you know, and they're to blame for a lot of the problems of Detroit. Then you bring up these issues and people say, but he gave money to Rosa Parks.
Right.
And it's like, well, he's dead. So they've used it as a shield now.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was a nice anecdote has been brought up so many times now that it's like, this is cover.
That's what I read it as. And like I say, I thought of you. I thought of the anecdotes you and the stories you told me one of the last times you were on the show. And I thought, oh, this is cover. This is them spinning this a little bit. You know, we've talked a lot about very universal topics, and we talked about Detroit and America and lots of different things here that. I don't know if they get it. I mean, we've learned a lot about you from that and your perspective on things. But my understanding is that ultimate success today is actually quite a personal record, and that term is kind of an umbrella term for your feelings about being in Protomartyr and what it might mean. Is there any truth to that? Am I off base there?
You're trying to steal second. You're off base. No, it's you. Yeah. I mean, ultimately this, I would say coming off of Relatives in Descent, where I tried to do a very loose connected series of songs about truths and everything, and wanting to like talk about the politics of the moment, and then kind of having, I felt like it was a very good album and it accomplished a lot of things that I wanted it to do. But then to have it kind of be like, you know, it was not, I don't know how to explain it.
You're talking about the reception to it was a bit muted?
I don't know if the reception, it just seemed like a lot of the things that I put into it personally just seemed to go past uncommented on or not, you know, and that's just that I believe that comes down to personal vanity. You know, you would like every one of your words parsed over and chewed on and things. And it seemed kind of passed over a little bit, which is, again, I think my own, you know, personal feelings on it. But
for what it's worth, didn't we go really thoroughly through every song on that one?
Right. Yeah. you're good, man. You're good. Don't worry about you.
No, I wasn't talking. I was a trend. I'm recalling this now, and I haven't revisited that conversation since it, you know, since it went out into the world. But I remember being really blown away by what you said about things and how willing you were to go through everything. And I thought it was really fascinating and I just thought that record was really fascinating and multi-layered. And then we put it out in the world, and I thought, you know, similarly to tearing a statue down, I fixed it. Job's done. Everyone's going to love Protomartyr now. We had a good discussion, so that takes care of that. And I just never thought about it again. You're saying perhaps not everyone shared your and my enthusiasm for the intricacies of those songs.
Right. I don't think I got the Smart King of the World award did not arrive in the mail. I thought it was going to.
You deserved it. I thought you deserved it. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really think like this is kind of a roundabout way to say the saying that I was writing about kind of very macro things, and for this one, I wanted to not. I knew right away. In the past, I always say, "Well, this next one could be a happy album. You know, we might actually write a happy album." I still hope that would happen, but I kind of knew that I wouldn't be able to repeat the trick twice with like it couldn't be. I didn't want to write "Relatives into the Descent Part 2," right. Where it would be here's an update on how shitty things are going in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I was feeling it was coming off approaching the end of a decade, which as you probably know, as you get older, you realize how few decades you have. You know, when you get to your fourth decade, you're like, Oh great. That was great. Boy, that sure went by fast. How many more of these do I got? You know, 1, 2, 3, you don't know.
Yeah.
And nobody knows, but it starts to become pretty obvious as you get older that you know, time's running out. So I had that going on in my head. And then also we had re-released the first record as, you know, kind of a stopgap since we toured so much and we didn't have time to work on a new album. It's the longest break we've had between albums, not even counting it being pushed back. So I was really being nostalgic for like, you know, the decade in review. It's like, well, the decade in review was we started the band and we put out the, you know, these four records. So I've got mortality playing with me, nostalgia. And then I was very, very sick last year with like, and I think it's just touring so much and then coming home and not doing anything and just kind of like have my body just kind of crashing. And, you know, famous rich people call it exhaustion. I don't know what I'd call it.
You were sporadically sick or you were specifically sick for a long period of time?
I was specifically sick for a long period of time where I just did not feel well. And combined with having very poor health insurance and a terrible fear of doctors, I just kind of was struggling with it. With myself trying to figure out how much of it was psychosomatic, how much of it was, you know, the chickens coming home to roost for, you know, lifestyle choices, not really taking care of this body, you know, and what I could do to change, you know, hoping that, oh, maybe if I wake up tomorrow, it will all be gone and I don't have to worry about it. So it was, that was all in play as I'm trying to write the next great Pruner Martyr record. You know,
okay.
My dad throughout his life would have migraines. I didn't have migraines. And then all of a sudden you hit 40, you start having migraines. So I got I have like weird, you know, weird pains, shooting up and down your body. And you're looking up online and everything is telling you that it's terrible, but you're too chicken shit to go to the doctor.
Well,
that was,
I've learned not to look, I've learned not to look things up online.
Right.
As a hypochondriac, it's the internet is there for you in the worst way.
So here's a sign that I don't know if you do this, you know, because I think I'm kind of because I just dwell on this stuff way too much.
Yeah.
Which I assume a lot of people do. The newest surprising thing that really hit me hard, and especially during the writing of the record, is I find myself watching a movie or something and looking up on Wikipedia and seeing. Just really focusing on how, like, when a person died, what they died of. Like, oh, wow, that person died when they were 42. Jeez, why did they die of?
Right.
Oh, boy, I sure hope I don't have that, you know. And so my Wikipedia was becoming a bummer for me, you know.
It's the internet. It's bad.
But also I would have – when I'm trying to, like, I was suffering from insomnia. And so your brain is racing and you're just having the darkest thoughts And, you know, it's so that is what informed this album. So it ended up, and I could have pretended, I could have been like, well, I'm going to write about other things. But it seemed like, all right, we got all these things in play. This is what I have to kind of write about. So it doesn't, which is, doesn't sound like I'm going to win the sales award this year when it comes to the album.
No. I can hear some, and I feel like there's some legacy stuff going on here, not just about you just pondering. You know, it's funny, we spent a lot of time talking about statues, and there's other monuments on this record, you know, carved lines upon the desert floor. That notion of permanently etching your it's basically the ancient, you know, Joe Casey was here. kind of approach to that's what history, a lot of history is. That's what a lot of artifacts are, monuments, statues. There are, I think, a couple of a few references to that sort of sentiment on this record. Is it fair to say you were thinking about that?
Yes.
This notion of things outliving their time on Earth, or out like the memory of something, or the symbolic. Here we go again. I'm circling. Right. The symbolic.
I'm a lyricist. I get to be symbolic.
That's true. Right. Yeah, you're entitled. That's true. But is that you were interested in that? The notion of things lasting throughout the years beyond maybe their actual existence, if you will.
Right, like a kiss from a rose. How poetic. No, yes, I mean, it's kind of, I do this on every album where there's one song, there's always the song about writing songs. And where, you know, My Children on the last record was definitely that, where, you know, it is about legacy and what you leave behind. And so, yeah, coming off a decade of being in a band and, you know, feeling the icy grip of mortality, and you wonder, you need to come to terms with impermanence, and you need to, and what it's interesting about this record is I don't think I come to accepting it at the end. And someone was like, oh, Warm in Heaven kind of sounds like it's kind of a nice, you know, calming way to end the album. And I would agree. It's kind of like, oh, I'm dead, and now here's my advice to you, and life can go on. But then the last, you know, 30 seconds of the song are, did I exist? You know, was there even a point to existence? And so it really ends on a clunker. As far as like, this is probably not worth it. You know, nothing is really like, I think it's a very honest record as far as my mind state at the time of writing it. And people would say, well, like when we were writing the press release of it, I wanted to mention the fact that I feel like it's the fifth act of a play and that it's dealing with all these issues, and it is sort of like closing the book on the first five albums are kind of a piece. And the label was like, this sounds like you're saying this is your last album. Don't do that. That's terrible for sales. But I wanted to have a sense of closure to this. So my obsessions and my feelings about that have been wrapped up in these five albums, I can kind of have a clean slate if we get a chance to make a sixth.
It is kind of weird. You, as a musician who goes into studios and makes records and documents your feelings at the time, you're this, so you kind of are this, you're freezing time every time you make a record. And a lot of the iconography around Proto Martyr is, in fact, statues, sculptures, this notion of people or figures or eras being frozen in time. And so you've done this in a sense now, Joe, I would say, by making five albums. You have frozen things in time that are going to outlast you. And outlast me, and outlast us, and that's fascinating. I mean, in a fleeting sense, lots of people do this every day, but and they come and they go is what I mean by a fleeting sense. But you've done that, so it does seem to be something that has been front of mind, I suppose. Just like you seem to be wondering about what your existence is all about, and these lines: I exist, I did, I was here, I was or never was. That does kind of sum up a lot of your mindset over five records, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. Like, I hope, and because really the history of the band was my dad dying and then me trying to stay busy after that and trying to realize that life was fleeting back in 2010 when it's like, hey, Greg, can you and Alex help me do a 7-inch? You know, from that point to now, it has been trying to make something of permanence in an impermanent world.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I would like to think that now that that's been discussed for five albums, I can hopefully live a lot or approach the next album as not being so wrapped up in legacy or the past, or, you know, I tried to write a science fiction, a futuristic song on this album, and it didn't go well because I was thinking, oh boy, if we could fly to, wouldn't it be great to fly to Mars? And then it's kind of like, I don't know if you saw that movie Ad Astra. The one great idea they had in that movie was that you go to the moon and the moon is full of Starbucks and, you know, fast food places. And it's like, it's not the utopian future that you hope for. It's the same shit that you're living in now, you know?
And so, on the new album, is this reflected in the song Modern Business Hymns or?
Yeah. That's the one.
Right.
And so it's, you know, I hope now that I've kind of, it is a sense of like, now that I've talked about this, I can move on to something new and whatever, maybe not worry about legacy, or, you know, I can finally write the great beach party song. You know? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's heartening to hear you quell your record label and your fans concerned that this is the last Protomartyr album. It sounds like it's the last of its kind, is what you're basically saying, and now you're gonna move on
it's to hope, like, it's, and again, I'm really worried that I'm not a psychic, because I would really hope for more Protomartyr records, but I wanted to kind of inspire the band, like, hey, we can keep doing this, but we don't need to be shackled to the past anymore.
Yeah.
We can, you know, it's a way to kind of restart your engines. And it really was brought upon thinking about like reissuing the first record and being like, wow, I was thinking about being an old, washed up nobody in the first record.
Right.
You, and that was 10 years ago.
You kind of came to this profession a little late, I guess, is maybe.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's funny to think. And so, but now the guys in the band are the age I was when we started the band.
Right.
So it's kind of, you have to like take that into account. And so it was a way to be like, let's be re-energized. And I, you know, with this album, I'm impressed with the level that the band is at, and like Greg's crazy ideas are continuing to hit for me satisfactorily, where I'm like, I can't believe he, you know, nothing for all the things that blow up in our face, which happens a lot. trying to put out a record about disease and illness during a pandemic, not a good idea. You know, starting a tour the day that the world shuts down, not a good idea. Putting out an album or a video inspired by RoboCop on the day when nobody likes cops, bad idea. You know, it's, we have some dumb luck, but we do have some good luck. And I feel like Greg being able to have artistic notion and being able to fulfill it repeatedly is very impressive to me.
It's a mighty and spirited sounding album. Just in case we've made it sound like some downer. It's a great, super well arranged and an excellent record, if I might say. Eddie Holman, by the way, is the author of that song that Ghostface sample is a nutmeg. So I'd like to figure out if maybe Greg and some of the boys there were keying into Ghostface or what have you. I don't know. But anyway, it's wonderful. And on many levels, you mentioned Kelly Deal at the beginning of this about an hour ago, and I didn't really get a chance to follow up. Does she play a role on the record?
No. I mean, like, I would say that she was a great influence on the fact that our collaboration with her on the last EP that we did, mm-hmm. Constellation EP, like the two songs that really work on that one are the two that she's has a heavy hand in collaborating with.
Right.
Whereas like we, you know, and we kind of wanted it to be heavier at the time, but like that experience was something that we were really profound into. And so that was kind of the goal of like true collaboration with people.
I see.
And it was, and this time it was different because we had done stuff with like our friend Olivier from France. We collaborated with people in the past, like pretty much on every album, mm-hmm. but they were friends, people that we knew. This is the first time that we kind of reached out to strangers where it's like, please, you know, will the songs hold up to scrutiny by strangers? You know, a friend might not tell you a song sucks and they'll still work on it. But you know, if you're getting somebody to come in that you don't know, like they have to like the songs.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kelly was going to be like, that is the most unlucky thing about it was that tour was, we had practiced the new songs with her doing guitar, keyboard, and backing vocals on all the new songs, some of the old songs, and it was amazing. We only got to play one show, and it was like, it went from being very tentative to being, I think, kind of a masterpiece of a show, considering that it was like, and stupidly through the whole show, I'm like, I hope you're enjoying the last show you'll ever see. Because I don't want to be psychic. So I really, and then we were going to tour. She was going to come out on the U.S. tour with us and the European tour. She was and is a member of the band at this point.
Yeah.
But because of everything's been pushed back, it's like when we finally poke our heads off out of the ground, is she going to be busy with something else? You know, the breeders, the bands that are more important in the grand scheme of things.
It is an interesting time to be closing a chapter of a band in hopes of potentially starting something new and different when we don't know what that world will look like in the next year, the next 2 years. We really don't know. So that's an interesting aspect of what we've been discussing as well. There is a voice other than yours on this record at least one point, right?
Right. There's my friend Corey from the band Spray Paint who helps out on Tranquilizer. Mm-hmm. And that's just to add some more weirdness to that song.
Yeah.
And then there's Nandi Rose who goes by Halfway when she releases solo records. And she adds backing vocals and vocals to like four or five songs on the album.
Right.
There's one that's pretty upfront, but and the other one's like, it's, she's got a lot more than you would think.
Okay. So, yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean to pick one, but there is the one that you mentioned, is, I think leads the song off, and it's a little jarring to hear that on a Protomartyr record. Not, it didn't like make me call the police. But which is a weird.
Wait, this Joe has such a beautiful voice. There he is. Yeah.
Intruder. That was a weird joke to make in this day and age. By the way, call the police. But whatever, I went with it. And all this to say, it's a wonderful record on many levels. And I thank you for talking about it and other things. If people want to learn more about Ultimate Success Today, where would you want to send them, Joe? In terms of the internet?
Good question. I suppose they can go to our website at www.protomartyrband.com. Mm-hmm. That, I think, has links to where you can pre-order it. Okay. I think that's – and then Domino Records, I'm sure they have – I haven't checked. Maybe they haven't got it set up yet.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they will by the time people hear this as well. But also, is there any – I know – you guys don't really engage with the social media channels. Is that still the case?
Yeah, and that's one of those things where I can grumble and be like, well, why are all these other bands getting so much bigger than us? And it's like, well, maybe it's because they give a shit about their fans, you know?
Right.
Our general theory was, as a band when we started, was nobody cares about us as people. And we think that's kind of fake to be.
Yeah.
Like, if we had an Instagram page, it'd be very boring. It wouldn't have any posts because we don't want to be like, look at us.
Yeah.
On tour. Here's our meals. Like, it's just. And we try to maintain a Twitter page just because we had one as limited as possible, where it's like, here's where you can buy something or go to the show. Just because I just feel like, number one, we're terribly boring people, and two, it just our person. Like, I don't like the idea of a band being based solely around personality.
Yeah, sure.
About the music.
You're not the Monkees, for crying out loud.
Right. Yes. As I talked to you for an hour trying to get people to buy the record. Anyway, my personal struggle is worth buying.
No, I'm
not giving away for free on the internet.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to all learn more about you from listening to the songs, probably, than you saying, here's me eating a sandwich.
Yeah. And I just feel, and I, as a band full of like white guys, I'm sure we'll be okay. But I feel like it just opens yourselves up to unnecessary abuse too.
Yeah.
Where you just be like, you know, on my limited Twitter interactions, there's like, oh, this is the crazy guy that threatens to murder us every couple weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
We have
those guys, and they're generally guys. It's almost always guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a weird
situation. So it's one of those things where it's like, if we're getting the amount of shit that we're getting on our very limited socials, then I can only imagine what some other people are getting.
Absolutely.
And you can see it happening where people are like, people are ending careers because they can't handle the social network aspect of it. So
yeah.
I think we're smart in staying off it.
Okay. Well, no, that's well put, and I respect that. So, again, people can go to your website and Domino's site to learn more about Ultimate Success Today and potentially, hopefully, someday, tour dates and other news. If we could go out on a song from this record, I don't know why I'm speaking very dramatically all of a sudden. What song would you select for us to hear, Joe?
Well, if I had to pick a song, I think one that kind of, while Worm in Heaven is the last song in the album, I feel like the song for me that kind of encapsulates the theme of the album and maybe the theme of the last, all five of the albums is Bridge and Crown, which is the second to last song on the album. So Bridge and Crown would be my choice.
Bridge and Crown reminded me of The Dentist, which I have a deep fear of. What is Bridge and Crown sort of about? Or what inspired it?
Well, you're very clever. You figured it does have my friend is studying to be a dentist, and I asked her if there's any like good dentist phrases or things that I could steal to use in a song. One is a calculus bridge, which this should be a name of a band or something.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been able to use that yet, so don't steal that.
I won't.
The bridge and crown was definitely a thing, but then she gave me the four types of patients. That when you're a dentist, and I'm sure when you're a doctor, you'll learn the four kind of responses that you'll get from patients.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's what starts the song. And I like that, Bridge and Crown, I like that these are things that you will be in your mouth and will last your whole life and will be there long after you're gone. And that it sounds like it could be like an old-timey pub somewhere.
Yeah.
Or a location. Yeah. So it has like anything that can have multiple meanings, and there is kind of a secret society thing in that song. But I feel like it's a reflective song that looks back on the past and kind of lays out exactly what Ultimate Success is, at least in that moment. So.
Does some iteration of Ultimate Success or Ultimate Success Today appear in almost every song?
Not quite. No, it's definitely in the first, and it's at least in.
I feel like it's in three or four songs. I want to say
right, but like the idea of the day, like to me, like there's nothing, the horror of insomnia and not being able to sleep and having the sun come up. Mm. And when you're trying to sleep in an old house that doesn't have air conditioning, it's like the day is worse than the night. Like I long for the night. You know, there's nothing frightening about the night to me. It's the day.
Yeah.
And so like that was the heat of the summer and the noise of insects out the window. That was definitely like a major touchstone for us.
Okay.
So, yeah.
For those of we're about to play it, but look out for these lines. Only four types of patients here: exacting, philosophical, indifferent, or hysterical. That's funny. I feel like I'm all of those when I go see a physician or a doctor or whatever. I'm all of them.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Well, it's good. Yeah. I mean, you can go through the different stages. I'm sure you're exacting about your being hysterical.
I think that's what it is. Definitely, I lean towards the hysterical when I'm at the dentist and I'm trying to get philosophical.
Yeah.
Or indifferent when I'm sitting there. But it's hard. I have a hard time. I'll tell you, I had some trauma when I was a kid, and it still affects me. So anyway, all in that spirit, this is Bridge and Crown.
Yay.
By Protomartyr. Joe, thank you so much for being back on the show and having this talk with me, and I wish you the best luck with everything going forward.
This is always a pleasure, and I like you checking in. Hopefully I'll be able to check in a couple of years with a new set of bummers and good questions about society and our role in it. And we'll solve all the problems, and then we'll do it again.
I agree. I think it's a date. How about I say that? It's a date, Joe.
Perfect. Perfect.
Thank you. When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Always means a lot to have Joe Casey of Protomartyr on the show. I feel like we have some nice, long, deep conversations. It means a lot. In this case, Joe was on the 552nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and Spotify and YouTube and other things as well. If you can't find an episode you're looking for on any of those things, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain the existence of this very podcast. You can make any kind of donation you want. You can change it at any time. I will say that anyone who donates $6 or more has access to exclusive audio content from my interviewing archives. As I'm speaking to you, the most recent one of these things just went up, featuring a 2012 conversation between myself and Killer Mike, whom you might know now as a member of Run the Jewels. When I spoke to him, it was about his 2012 solo album, Rap Music, which I still am a huge fan of. And so I just put that up. Prior to Killer Mike, Fugazi, a conversation with Fugazi from 2011. D.A. Pennybaker has been on the show, is featured. The late D.A. Pennybaker was featured on the thing. The late Hal Wilner. Anyway, there's lots of interesting content there, and extra content as a little treat for those who support the show, donate to the show. So again, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make your flexible monthly donation today. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. Man, I wish I could sample all of their wares, but here I am in Alberta, and I can't. But I miss them, and they support the show with in-kind support. So thank you very much to all of them. Jim Guthrie lets me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim and his amazing catalog of sound at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Joe Casey of Protomartyr. Again, this was his third appearance on the show. Hopefully, if you like this, go. I haven't listened to the other appearances in a long time. I presume they were okay. Joe keeps coming back, and I keep wanting him back. We have a nice time. So, lots of content, episodes to check out. So go to my website or whatever your podcast platform is and dig into the show and tell your friends about the show and subscribe to the show and all those things. It means a lot. And yeah, that's it from Creative Control for another episode. I will talk to you very soon with yet another episode, presumably. I will talk to you, like I say, very soon. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.